morning. This is KUNV 91.5, and you're listening to Neon Eden. I'm your host, J. Patrick Kulikin. You can read my column in the Las Vegas Sun. My co-host, as always, Las Vegas Sun reporter Tovin Lapan. Today, we welcome friend of the program, Dave DeMore. He's a UNLV political scientist. We'll talk about the opening of the legislative session, perhaps the sequestration apocalypse, recent polling, and political goings-on. Dave, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about the legislative session. I think we're in week three, four mm-hmm. already. What are your impressions so far?
Well, so far you see, I think, a little more open dialogue than we had last couple of sessions. I mean, instead of waiting till May to talk about taxes, we're still talking about it now, but still there's nothing definitive on the table yet. But you have sort of talked a little bit about that. I think the one consensus is both parties in the legislature don't like the margins tax proposal. And the question is, will they come up with something different? Will they have another measure on the ballot, which would complicate it for voters? So that's a little bit of an unknown there.
And let's just go back. You're talking about the teachers' tax initiative, mm-hmm. teachers' union tax initiative would raise $800 million, I mm-hmm. think, per year.
Yeah, and it's supposed to be earmarked for education.
Right, and this would go before the voters in 2014,
mm-hmm.
but the legislature has 40 days
to act on it, either to pass it or to come up with an alternative which they can put on the ballot or really do nothing.
And then it goes on the ballot.
And then it would go on the ballot.
Uh-huh. I would guess they're not going to do anything about it.
That's my guess. I think that the argument is if you only have one thing on the proposal, on the ballot, it's easier to kill than if you have multiple competing measures that tend to confuse voters.
And any other, I think we're seeing some of the side issues that we're always going to see pop up and start to dominate the conversation.
Construction defect, for example, that's going to get a lot of attention, I think. Uh-huh. Roberson's really pushing that legislation there. Builders and developers, kind of versus the trial lawyers.
Right, the trial lawyers representing homeowners, ostensibly.
And, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so that's been obviously a lingering issue that always comes up every 2 years, and they sort of tweak it or not, depending which party controls the various branches of government. So that certainly is in there, and obviously you've had one tax legislation passed out of the Assembly so far, the changes to the consolidated tax. Got through the Assembly very, very quickly. That was the Speaker's pet project, and she pushed that very quickly. And, of course, last week we saw how quickly the legislature can act when it's motivated by the governor and apparently some competition with New Jersey to pass the online gaming bill.
And this allows Nevadans to gamble. Only Nevada.
And also sets up a framework for Nevada to create compacts with other states and say, basically, we would run your online gaming, if the federal government gets their act together. But I think there's a real concern that the lotteries are moving in this direction. And that's, I think, the concern for some of the big companies here about getting beat to the punch by the lotteries.
So you can go and get a Powerball ticket online.
Mm-hmm. And then eventually the next thing would be some sort of online gaming
uh-huh.
platform.
Uh-huh. So we need to be first on that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the early part of the session has been taken up by the saga of Stephen Brooks, which seems to be, I don't know what is the status of that is.
I mean, every day there seems like another headline. And when they got last week, he tried to buy a gun up in Sparks, allegedly for hunting elk. And mm-hmm. elk season not till the fall. I think at this point, I think people sort of hope that he would resign, but I don't think that's going to happen. So he's going to force them to sort of actually figure out what they want to do with this special committee they've created, what steps they can have. And my sense is really twofold on this. The first is this is a huge distraction, taking up a lot of valuable time just addressing this. It gets a lot of the media coverage.
When you only have 120 days.
Exactly, when you only have 120 days, You know, and you have a small legislator on top of this. So this is someone who's on a couple of important committees. He's on the health committee dealing with
ways and means.
In ways and means as well. So you have one less voice, one less person pulling their weight there on those important committees there. And, of course, for his constituents, right? They elect this guy in November, and then all this stuff sort of falls apart, and now they really don't have any voice in this, right? And so he's from North Las Vegas. There's been a big dust-up in North Las Vegas over the consolidated tax, and that's one less voice that they had really to push their case.
The city kind of always teetering on the edge of bankruptcy. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, absolutely there. So, you know, it's. I think, as I said, I think the hope was that this would just sort of work its way out, but I don't think it's going to.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, this is almost a personal question, an issue that came up last time, guns on campus.
Yeah, this has been, I think Stavros Anthony way back when was the one to first push it, and then last session John Lee carried it, and now Michelle Fiore is carrying it, and she had an editorial, I believe, in the Las Vegas Sun today, ducking it. There's no support for this in the higher ed community. This is just not something we want, and I think, you know, we've never really been asked about
this.
Well,
that's because you're a bunch of pinko.
Exactly. But even our police chief, right? Our police chief, the UNLV police chief, has been very much against it.
Well, because he wants to be a tyrant with all the guns.
I suppose so. So, you know, this is just sort of one of these...
I don't know. I actually don't know the answers. Maybe you do. Is Michelle Fiore, does she have any experience with higher education?
Not that I know of. I mean, she's never been active. I've never seen her on campus, and she's never been involved.
Is she a college graduate?
That I don't know. Okay. That I don't know. You know, everybody says she's pretty sharp, but this is, you know, an ideological bill. And, you know, it's one of those bills that's going to get a lot of media attention, but here you have a freshman in the minority in the assembly trying to push this legislation. My guess it's going to be, you know, get more attention than outside the legislature than it might get inside the legislature.
Someone's going to slip it in a drawer, and it's never going to be seen.
Exactly,
again, you know?
Exactly.
Tick Segerblum, probably.
Tick Segerblum, I guess, yeah. Or whoever, yeah.
Let's talk about just today, as we're taping on Monday, the Democrats have come out with an education plan. We'll have to get more details later, but it seems like it's, as you put it, it's kind of the full fry.
Mm-hmm.
With a $310 million price tag.
Yeah, and that's covering, you know, the cost of full-day kindergarten for everybody. Right now you have this sort of system where depending where you live determines what kind of access your kids get to all-day kindergarten. You either get the state will pay for it or it won't be offered, or parents can pay about $3,000 a year to have their kids in all-day kindergarten. So you have this sort of uneven situation there. And, of course, we also know there's a big emphasis for what happens before kindergarten, right? That is providing some sort of... particularly for those in impoverished parts of the valley, access to preschool. Because, you know, when you go to kindergarten, right, the difference between kids who have been in preschool and have not is dramatic. And those kids are starting so far behind, not just in terms of academically, but in terms of socially, you know, interact in the school setting there. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you have the ELL issue, the English Language Learner question, and there was a forum on Saturday sort of discussing that, talking about, you know, what it is, the crisis here. And you have a lot of dimensions to that. The first is obviously there's a lot of upfront costs for that because we don't fund it at all now. There's no state money that goes for that. And because there's no state money, we get the least amount of the federal match. So we're only dependent on the federal dollars. So you have that, but you're talking about... not just throwing money at it, you're talking about ensuring you have teacher training, you have stipends to encourage the best teachers to go do this. And just demographically, it's something that has to be done. If you're a business owner and you're thinking ahead 15, 20 years, thinking about what the state's going to look like, and you already have, you know, we already get knocked around for our education standing, and then you have this huge demographic that's unable to speak English. Mm-hmm. How's that going to do for our economic diversification issues there?
Well, if you're a payday lender, it's...
exactly, I suppose, or you build a prison or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the data that they're able to put together shows how many of these people are also part of the dropout problem. So you're having sort of two problems here. You're having kids not learning because they don't know the language, and then eventually they just say, school's not for me, I can't engage, and they drop out, and we know that they're going
to help explain why.
Exactly, you're going to earn less money, you're going to be less engaged citizen, and you're probably going to end up using more government services in the long haul. So there's this, you know, but as we know, because of the way Nevada works, is we never think long term. It's all about the Band-Aids for the next 2 months to 2 years to get us through, and we'll try to deal that down the road. I think you have a sense now that there's at least, I think, agreement as to what needs to be done. The question is, can we do it, and where's the money going to come from?
Mm-hmm. And I think it was over the weekend, the Retailers Association poll came out, and they sort of touched on several areas that are, I guess, the hot issues. Mm-hmm. And so what did they find in that poll?
There's a couple of interesting things. It's a really broad-based poll. They asked a lot of issues, things like legalization of marijuana, same-sex marriage, some of those types of issues. There, immigration as well. But a lot of it's dealing with the tax and business climate. And what was interesting was for the first time you've seen education surpass jobs and the economy as the most important issue for Nevadans here. So there's a lot of interest in improving our education. I think people realize that if we're ever going to get beyond gaming and mining, we're going to need to have a more educated population here. Unfortunately, we didn't bother to invest in that when we had money. And now when you're trying to do it without any money and your competitors, your Utahs and your Arizonas are light years ahead of us, it's really, really tough to do there. They did find support for the margins tax, the teachers initiative that we were talking about a moment ago. It's about 60-40 when you put the strong and leaning support in there. On that one there, but you also get the typical schizophrenia you see in any polls on taxes. That is, yes, I'd be willing to pay more on taxes if I knew it was going to go for services that I wanted that would be used effectively, but if not, and it hurts businesses, I don't really support it, and we should try to cut the waste there. So you sort of see that coming through in the poll as well there. But it was interesting, you sort of see this, I think this sort of see what we're seeing nationally, you're also seeing here in Nevada, just sort of took on the same-sex marriage, middle part of last decade, we amended our constitution to outlaw it now. Mm-hmm. There's strong support for saying, hey, this is what's the big deal here? And I think you're seeing similar shifts on marijuana-related issues as well, which is something that was tried in the middle part of last decade as well, which failed pretty much, was it 40-60 or something like that.
And that's something that's come up in the legislature this year, that to actually fulfill, like Nevada was supposed to make it available, marijuana to at least medical patients, right? And that really has never come to fruition.
No, they never put up a framework. The voters passed it, and there was never really a framework.
And the initiative required the legislature to do so, and they just ignored it.
And they just
it.
Simply didn't do it here. So you have this sort of Neverland for these people who get the cards but really don't have any ability to get marijuana in the regulated environment outside of the black market.
Is there, you think there's the will to get that done, or is this another one of those bills that's going to
Well, I mean, I think, Tig Seeger Bloom, who's chairing the Senate Judiciary, this is a little bit of a big issue for him. So you have that sort of institutional clout there. But again, with 120 days, how many, you got all these other issues out there. How much interest is it going to be there? What's the governor going to do when this comes before his desk?
Right.
Some of those issues, I think, what you see in a poll doesn't obviously translate into legislative action.
Right. And then, of course, the Supreme Court is going to take up the issue of gay marriage, at least the California case. So they rule on that could certainly affect
Data, exactly. Right? And that'll be interesting because they also have two cases. They have the DOMA case out of New York as well. So that, I think there's a lot of states sort of waiting to see what's going to happen on that. But I could see them trying to cut a narrow path on that too and leave the states a fair amount of autonomy, which would still leave the opportunity for the legislature to begin the process, to begin to amend the Constitution to get that out of
there. We need to act twice, right?
The legislature has to act twice for a referendum, two consecutive sessions, and the voters only have to pass it once. If it starts with the voters, they have to pass it twice. But since this would be a legislative referendum, it would pass, if they pass it this time, it would go in 2015, and then it would be on the ballot in 2016.
Okay. So twice plus the voters.
Plus the voters to amend the Constitution. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And that would pass overwhelmingly, I would think.
I can't imagine it would be hard to put the resources that you found just a few years ago.
So you don't need the governor on this?
No, bypass the governor. That's the beauty of the legislative referendum. Why do you think they're going to do the mining tax that way?
Right. That's a good segue. What do you think? I've heard that momentum might be dying for taking the mining taxes privileged place in the state constitution out.
For SJR 15. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, you only
need a real champion was Sheila Leslie. Yeah. She's not there anymore.
Exactly. I mean, you only need majority vote. I think it'll pass the assembly fairly easily. Mm-hmm. The question is there enough folks in the Senate who would?
There are more mining lobbyists than there are
senators. Exactly. But, you know, you look last time, Kiekeper voted for it. Roberson voted for it. I think Debbie Smith, when she was the assembly, she voted for it. So those are, you know, particularly Kiekeper and Debbie Smith are up north. And if
Kiekeper and Roberson will get turned.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. On that one there, they're kind of the key votes there. You now have Scott Hammond in there as well, who's down here. I don't know how much allegiances he has to the mining industry. And, of course, you have Hutchinson as well, another new member who didn't vote last time on that. Mm-hmm. It's a good question. You see this army of lobbyists up there. You see this army of PR spending, the sort of, you know, the billboards and then the advertising and so forth. And the fact of the matter is it doesn't actually raise the taxes. It just gives the legislature the opportunity to do that. And you still would then
need two-thirds.
You would still need two-thirds to change the law that's on the book there. So it's not going to – all of a sudden mining is going to effectively – double or triple their payments to the state here. It creates the opportunity to do that. Mm-hmm. But it'll be interesting. It will be interesting to see how that one plays out. I think obviously the Senate and particularly the Southern Republicans are the ones to watch.
Well, actually, I think it's the Southern Democrats who are the ones to watch. Yeah, because you know, they're the ones who the mining industry will need to turn on this. And I think some of them are frankly vulnerable to being turned. Calvin Atkinson's, for instance.
Or a Justin Jones who has to run again in 2 years.
Mm-hmm. They don't want to see a flood of mining money oppose them. And
see what happened to Sheila Leslie, that close race and turned against her. You're such a pessimist, Patrick.
they, you know, and they some of them tend to be, I don't know, what's the word, suggestible.
Yeah. No, I've heard your point in that is that, you know, if you take them out of the Constitution, this is the most they'll ever pay, right? Because they'll be able to use their resources to sort of stop any changes in the taxes. So we might as well get something out of them as opposed to potentially getting nothing out of them. Mm-hmm. We'll see. But eventually you could get, you know, planning could go the ballot initiative route as well once you get them out of the Constitution.
Right. You're on sabbatical now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and you have I think you're doing some interesting scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that a little bit.
Well, right now I'm finishing up some of the stuff we did for Latino decisions over the course of the election. We're going to do a conference next month. We're presenting the sort of all the polling we did over the course of the election. That'll go into a book. My colleague John Tooman and I are also doing a big sort of data collection project trying to create a profile of the Nevada Latino community economically, educationally, socially, and, of course, geographically and politically as well. And we're going to start putting some parts of that out in the next couple of weeks, hopefully. But the real project is a book-length manuscript looking at many of these issues, and that is sort of the north-south divide in Nevada and why it is the way it is. Why does mining have this privileged price? What has that meant over time? What does it mean for us when we don't even get incorporated as a county until 1910? You don't have any population here until really after World War II. You know, and even up to then, because of malapportionment, you had no representation in the legislature. And then even when we get representation, we have no seniority and no clout because service down here is no fun as compared to the north. And of course, we sent up a split delegation. So, sort of looking at all those sort of issues at key time points and looking at how these sort of who's actually making these decisions there and where, you know, and then part of it also is where is the physical presence of government, right? You have this disjuncture between most of the government services and most of the government employees and most of the infrastructure governor is 450 miles away from the people, populated by people who are demographically very different from the people down in southern Nevada here. So you have that disconnect there as well. So sort of looking at all those issues in pulling in better and obviously coming up, I think, with a set of reforms that might be reasonable. And getting us out of this sort of boom-bust mindset and this notion that we're no longer can count on these sort of mining and gaming and being this island that we need to think about competing against the Utahs and the Arizonas who made these investments over the decades and are light years ahead of us. You know, that's the big project.
Uh-huh. Connect those two, you see this, the north-south divide and the south's long subjugation at the hands of the north. And two, how is that related to becoming a more modern state that is on the par with Utah and Arizona? How are those? They seem like separate things.
Well, they're not, though, because, you know, the northerners never really engaged the south. Right, they see state government, they see the University of Nevada Reno, that's theirs, right? And then they don't want it messed with. And any change to the status quo, they know is going to hurt their interests, right? You start talking, I mean, the fights over K-12 funding, higher ed, you think those are sort of blood sports. It's like, how is it, it seems like absurd to them to think that you'd actually put government services and money where the people are. that just simply doesn't we're comfortable here and that's fine and we'll make do here. Now you look what Arizona did, right? When Phoenix starts booming, right? You have University of Arizona in Tucson. They have a medical school, sort of the UNR, if you will, of Arizona, and then you have Arizona State, this emerging urban second tier school at the time. But they saw what could be. You needed a major university in your urban center, and so they started juicing up Arizona State. Now you have the Mayo Clinic there. They're doing all kinds of wonderful things at University of Arizona because they had the forethought.
You mean at Arizona State?
Arizona State, excuse me, 20 years ago to think about what we would need to do here. And here, because we're dealing with a zero-sum budget, anything that comes south is going to come out of the north. We've never had the institutional expertise, the seniority, to sort of put it all together. And, of course, we always send up the split delegation who would be willing to be played off partisan-wise. And then you have, the basic organization of Nevada government is these counties. Well, that makes sense in counties of 700 people, but not in a county of 2 million, right? So you have the county versus the municipalities. You play them off against each other and against the state. In 120 days, it's over. I mean, the real genius move of this whole thing is Raggio in 98 changing the Constitution to put in the 120-day session because he, used to be able to go indefinitely, and he just was able to do that, and he controlled all the cards, and he knew when the end game was going to be there, so he cut the deals he wanted to cut. But at some point, it becomes self-defeating, right? When you keep starving the economic engine, you're not educating the population at a level that will allow them to go out there and in business say, hey, look, they've got good education or they've got good health care here. I mean, some of the stats we dig out are just unbelievable. I mean, we're the largest city in the country without a medical school, right? The road between Phoenix and Las Vegas, right? We're the two largest cities in the country without an interstate, right? These are not accidents why this happened, but now here we are looking about, well, why can't we diversify our economy? Why can't we scale anything in here? Because you never invested in the population center.
It sounds a little almost like they've treated us like a colony.
Well, I'll probably get in trouble for saying this, but the analogy I make is mining treats the north like a colony, and so they want to get their own colony. And that's effectively what they did. And you have a population in Nevada that's transient. They're not invested here. And the attitudes are just different here. Their skills are bureaucratic and political. That's what they've gotten good at. There's a reason why Raggio has a statue in the airport there. our skill set are entrepreneurial and visionary. People come here, what can I do to get it done? What do I need to get my vision realized? What do I need to do? I don't want to go fight the political game. I'll do whatever I have to do.
Or who can I scam?
Exactly. I mean, you look at, take, for example, the Beltway versus the I-50 580, right? The new interstate between Reno and Carson City. They started planning that in the 1960s. I mean, that's when that started going on the books and fighting that bureaucratic fight. That whole period of time, for us, we couldn't wait 40 years to build the Beltway. Can you imagine what this place would be like? So what did we do? We went to legislature, said we want to tax ourselves, and we'll build it. And that's all. The only part that the state actually has to deal with is 215. The rest of it is all a county road, and we have to pay for the maintenance of it, all that kind of stuff there. And so, the bottom line is they've created so much infrastructure that they essentially can't afford to pay for it themselves, right? So in most states, a region of 500,000 people would be able to support themselves, right, would have been able to take these assets that the state invested there and do something with them. But look at their medical school, right? There's no biotech around there. There's no industry that's supporting that. It's never grown and developed to be a medical school of any standing there. I mean, just last week or last month, the Faculty Senate of the University of Nevada, Reno released their sort of vision of the UNR down the future. Their goal is to be a mid-tier Cal State. Okay, this is a 150-year-old institution with a medical school that's PhD granting, and that's how they see their peer groups here. So we've been this sort of island that's been able to count on gaming and, to a lesser extent, mining. At least mining provides good jobs in northern Nevada, and they may not pay a lot in the general fund, but they do provide that. And now it's just not enough. It's just simply not enough. I mean, you see, I think Dave Schwartz had that great piece showing how the gaming contribution used to be, what, 56% of the budget? Now it's down to 46% of the budget. Mm-hmm. And there hasn't been anything to really fill that difference because you can gamble every year. Every 2 years, I mean, the share of the gaming tax goes down and down and down, and there's nothing to replace it.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating conversation. I think we'll continue this a bunch more. Let's go back to politics. 2014. Everything's kind of quiet right now, I guess, maybe until the legislature is finished.
I mean, I think you have some people out there making some moves to see, particularly on the Democratic side. You know, you have the reshuffling of the seats with Ross Miller. You know, he's term limited out, and the AG, Catherine Cortez Masto, is termed out, and they're two very viable candidates. I think, no surprise, Ross Miller is probably going to run for attorney general, but I think Cortez Masto is a little bit of a wild card. Where is she going to go? How are you going to go from AG to lieutenant governor? Not too exciting. Is she going to take on Sandoval? You know, that would be a very, very interesting race.
She's the one Democrat who can beat him.
Mm-hmm, probably, potentially. Right? And, you know, Sisolak would have the money if he's able to make it a north-south issue.
What would be the rationale for his, I guess, north-south? But yeah. Other than that, I don't understand what the rationale of his campaign is. I mean, he's very much like Sandoval's politics are.
Exactly. Sort of center of the road on that one there. Yeah, you know, ambition. I would be my guess to say it, but
because I want to be governor.
Well, I mean, you know, and also, you know, if Harry Reid's, you know, 2016 the big year for Harry Reid too, so people might be thinking about getting statewide exposure if Reid decides not to run as well. That's a big opportunity on that one there. I think, you know, you'll see Kate Marshall, she'll run for Secretary of State. I don't think they're much surprised about that. I think you'll see Kim Whelan will run from Controller to Treasurer. So you'll see a little bit of a reshuffling there. You'll have some new faces in the legislature. Some of the Sagaski will be termed out, for example, there. Roberson will have a tough fight, given the nature of his district there. And, of course, I think there'll be a lot of interest. Probably, you know, the Congressional District 3rd will be a very, very interesting race. You know, Hex sort of trying to right now fight off a potential Tea Party challenge, but he needs to be thinking about what's going to happen in that district if he has to face Bilbray. Mm-hmm. I think it'll be a very good candidate.
Aaron Bilbray, yeah. Yeah, a woman running
in a swing district that's increasingly, you know, it's a little more whiter than, say, the first or the second, but it's got a huge non-white component to it, and it's an even district.
Mm-hmm. A sexist gaffe always seems like a possibility.
You think so?
Maybe.
You think so?
I don't know. All right, Dave DeMoor, UNLV political scientist, thanks so much for joining us. Our producer is Steven Zeller. My co-host is Tovin LePan. I'm Patrick Kulik, and you've been listening to KUNV 91.5 Neon Eden. Catch us next week.